Stronger communities begin with good health for everyone. Women's health is foundational to their own wellness and that of their families and communities. Yet millions of women aren't certain of options or connected with the care they deserve. Welcome to the Good Health, Better World podcast presented by UPMC Health Plan. I'm your host, Dr. Ellen Beckjord. This season, we talk about empowering women in their health journey across their lifespan and uncover challenges and opportunities in clinical advances in women's health. Join us for a series of conversations on the spectrum of women's health from every stage and age in life. Let's dive in. In this episode, we talk with Dr. Sarah Tilstra, Section Chief of Women's Health and internist at the General Internal Medicine Clinic at Montefiore Hospital at UPMC, about how sex and gender impact health and healthcare. Dr. Tilstra, welcome to Good Health, Better World.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today, we're talking about how sex and gender play a role in health, in healthcare, and in health disparities. So as we start, could you please define sex and gender for us and talk about how these terms are used in the healthcare setting?
So the way that we define gender in the healthcare world is really, it's a social construct. It's on a very long spectrum, and it's not thought to be binary. We used to think of it as very male or female dominant, but people can identify however they want on the gender spectrum, and it's not really up to their healthcare provider to define that for them. So when people come into the clinic, we use the terms they want to use to identify their gender expression, their gender identity. This can be the same or different than their sex assigned at birth. And when it's different, we say that it's gender incongruence. So sex assigned at birth is really defined at birth by usually the provider, oftentimes just by looking at the genitalia, or it can be determined traditionally by ultrasound at about 20 weeks, and that's by looking at the genitalia. And when we think of gender and sex, they can be congruent or non-congruent.
I appreciate that you're helping us understand the distinction between gender and sex assigned at birth. And as you said, gender is much more fluid, exists on a continuum, is really gender identity is determined by the person who's receiving care in the healthcare system. And so you're, in the context of women's health, you and your colleagues are taking care of people who identify as female and were assigned, their sex at birth was female, but you're also taking care of people whose sex assigned at birth might not have been female, but their gender identity is female or is fluid and non-binary. And so those are sort of, I guess, the different permutations that can exist and have to be accounted for now as you think about how to care for any of your patients, but especially in the context of, I guess, women's health.
Correct. So when patients come into the clinic, one of the first questions out of the gate that we always ask is, you know, what is your chosen name and what are your chosen pronouns? And can you please talk about your gender identity for us? And that helps us kind of help take care of them both from a gender context and from a sex-specific healthcare context.
And if we stick with gender for a moment, I would also be interested to hear you talk about how sex assigned at birth affects different decisions in the care delivery space. But if we talk about gender and we talk about gender roles, thinking about gender, as you said, as a social construct, particularly as they apply to people who identify as women, how do gender roles affect women in the context of their health? I'm sure there's so many ways, but what are some of the, I guess, first things that come to mind for you as you think about ways that gender roles affect health, particularly for people who identify as female?
Yeah, so traditionally, you know, we think of the gender roles of women being the healthcare providers. And the good news is that gender roles are becoming a little bit more loose over the years. You know, male parents and male partners are becoming, you know, more childcare providers, and they're helping out more along the house. But even if women go into the workforce and work full-time jobs, they're really still the on parent. And we have this concept called the on parent, where if you are the on parent, you're still really responsible for the parenting and the driving and the meal prep and the doctor planning and the birthday party planning. And when you're responsible for all of these things in the home, really the things that with your own health care, you kind of lose sight of. And those gender-specific roles that women tend to do really don't help them get into the clinic and take care of their own health care. There's also this concept that women go through, which is like healthcare gaslighting. And so healthcare gaslighting, in terms of women tend to have a lot more somatic symptoms related to disease than men do. And when they present with, you know, chest pain or belly pain or migraine headaches or very nonspecific symptoms, a lot of times they get this feel from the healthcare community that it's all in their head or that it's related to their hormones. And so when they have this experience in healthcare, they're much less likely to present the second time around, which, you know, clearly affects their healthcare and delays the time to diagnosis for disease the next time.
Yeah, I think it would be great to just unpack what healthcare gaslighting is and say how it may be at play for women in general, but maybe even more at play for women of color or women who identify as sexual or gender minorities. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so we were talking about healthcare gaslighting. And the interesting thing about this is that absolutely applies to women, but the broader experience is that it applies to other minority groups, women of color, particularly women of color who are pregnant or immediately postpartum, sexual and gender minorities. And I was reading an article recently about Serena Williams and her pregnancy complications and about how she had to so forcefully advocate for herself to get a CT scan because she knew she had a huge pulmonary embolism, which she had had before. And then the recent story of the U.S. Olympic track team, how three of the four Olympic medal winners had had pregnancy complications. And these are star athletes at the prime of their health, and they are still experiencing preeclampsia, eclampsia. One recently died. And so the healthcare gaslighting that these women have experienced, I think it's probably twofold. One, I think there's a bias thinking that these women have really healthy bodies and that we're just underdiagnosing them because we think that they're healthy at baseline. But two, that, you know, women come to the table with all of these other somatic complaints that we don't take seriously. Or when women advocate for themselves, they're being bossy or they're being difficult, you know, or, you know, and sometimes that's what women have to do to get somebody to listen to them, especially when they're sick or ill. And healthcare providers don't necessarily respond to somebody telling them what to do very often, especially when they have gender or cultural discrepancies in terms of the healthcare provider relationship.
That really feels like I suppose it's not really a catch-22, but as you're talking, I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine about how I think there is also a tendency, and we were sort of talking about psychiatric realm and psychiatric diagnoses, that my perception may not be one that everyone agrees with, is that there's a long history of pathologizing female experience.
Yes.
And then at the same time, there is a long history of sort of denying female symptom presentation in the healthcare setting. And that, you know, those two things, it's sort of like either pathologize and treat or, you know, deny and ignore. But, you know, the mix of the two leaves women really in a lurch often when it comes to getting appropriate care for the concerns that they have about their health.
So we definitely know that there are some conditions that are sex-related, and we know that there are some healthcare conditions which gender and sex absolutely play a role. One of these is, you know, coronary disease. And so women tend to present later when they have coronary symptoms. They tend to present differently, but they also have sex differences in terms of hormones that absolutely affect their vessels. And so while they actually have less atherosclerotic disease in their blood vessels, they often have worse outcomes because of the way that they identify in their gender roles and who they are. They present later. They're more stigmatized when they come to the emergency department. They don't really receive as, you know, goal-directed therapy as well as men do. And so their outcomes tend to be a little bit worse. Also, COPD tends to be a little bit more severe in women, despite lower smoking rates. So that might just be sex-related. You know, autoimmune disease plays a big role in women. Clearly, that could be sex-related because it's more of a physiologic, biologic standpoint. Osteoporosis, clearly with bone disease, you know, hormones absolutely play a big role in that. So a perfect example of a typical female gender role is actually my mother. So at the age of 50, she had a heart attack, early heart attack for a woman, and she actually lives two blocks away from me, and now she is 75. And so she called me one day at 10 p.m. and said, "Sarah, my neck hurts, and it feels exactly the way that it did 25 years ago when I had my heart attack." I said, "Okay, great, let's go to the ER." She goes, "Well, it actually started hurting 10 hours ago, and I put a heating pad on it." I said, "Mom, why did you do that?" She's like, "I didn't want to bother you." And so that's a perfect example of a woman not wanting to bother her doctor daughter who lives two blocks away from her because she felt that she would be a burden to someone, and even though she actually knew exactly what was going on, and she deferred her health care. And so by the time she got to the emergency department, she went for an emergency catheterization, and she had a 99% blockage in her artery. She did fine, but it's still, we hear stories like this over and over and over again of women delaying healthcare.
So here's a woman who is able to recognize the symptom of neck pain as possibly meaning something very serious related to their heart because of the experience 25 years earlier. And we know that women, as you had mentioned, symptoms associated with coronary disease present differently and may not have the classic, you know, crushing chest pain. So your mom knows to recognize this neck pain as an important symptom. She has a daughter who's a physician who lives two blocks away and still delays for almost half a day reaching out to you and then very fortunately is able to get the intervention that she needs to save her life. But if it's that challenging for a woman with as much awareness and resource as your mom, we know that it's exponentially harder for most people.
Yeah, exactly. And women are really attached to their provider. And so when they have a provider they can confide in and feel that, you know, they can trust with their health care, things get a lot better. But when they don't have that person that they can go to, they tend to defer away from the healthcare system. We have patients that call into our clinic all the time, and I'm lucky enough to have 25 female academic women's health partners. And so our clinic is, you know, very, very competent in women's healthcare. But when a patient calls in and they can't see their primary provider, they will sit at home for a week with their heart attack rather than see somebody else for their healthcare. And that just goes to show that we need better trust in the healthcare system and we need to do better for these women.
The relationship with providers is really important. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a quick question about the pandemic, and then I'd love to talk with you about your book. Mm-hmm. But before we go there, I like the term the quote-unquote on parent, and you gave a long list of ways to identify the on parent, who plans the birthday parties, who schedules the healthcare appointments. You know, I always feel like who buys the socks, right? Like these sort of edge tasks that always sort of fall to the on parent. And you mentioned that there has been, and I would agree, I think we can say that we've observed some loosening of those gender roles or some emerging equity in tasks shared when there are two parents in a household, that there still may be one on parent, but there's been a more equitable distribution of tasks mm-hmm. for a lot of modern families. But I wonder if you think that the experience of the height of the pandemic set us back a little bit. I mean, I can remember reading in the press and even some research, I think, that was really documenting, and even before the pandemic, but certainly during the pandemic, that women were disproportionately shouldering the burden of tasks that emerged as a function of the lockdown. And mm-hmm. I believe that we know that women disproportionately left the workforce during the mm-hmm. pandemic, likely related to having many more tasks to attend to as the quote-unquote mm-hmm. on parent. Was that your observation from the, you know, perspective that you're seeing the world as a provider for women's health?
Absolutely. And that actually has still holds true today. And so when everyone kind of took a step back from the workforce and almost everybody was working at home, even when dual couples were working at home, it was primarily mom's job to work from home and do the online school and still order Instacart and still do the things at home that needed to be done while the other co-parent was doing the full-time job at home. And then as people trickled back to the workforce, it was usually mom that deferred out and didn't necessarily go outside the home. It was also during that time that women had a really hard time taking their kids to the clinic. And so kids weren't allowed in clinics for 2 to 3 years. And so single parents actually couldn't go in to get their own health care done unless they got childcare. And that was really an issue when nobody was commingling or intermingling and wanted to watch your kids while you went to the doctor or went to the hospital. You know, no mom could go sit in an ER for an appendicitis because she had childcare. And so a lot of things kind of went by the wayside for the pandemic, and we're just now starting to catch up.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it feels like another example of ways that the experience of the pandemic just intensified or amplified problems that already existed. You know, you had mentioned it wasn't a new challenge for women and women who are the quote-unquote on parent needing to carve out time for their own health and well-being. But what little time they maybe typically had been able to was probably even shrunk even more when so much was happening at the height of the pandemic. So I appreciate your mentioning that.
There are some studies, especially in postpartum care, where online telehealth visits has actually shrunk the disparities in access to care, especially for high-risk women. And so that was used as a model to get women back into healthcare, but there still exists a disparity.
Well, let's talk about your book. So you are the executive editor of the book Sex and Gender-Based Women's Health, A Practical Guide for Primary Care. Inclusive training and guidance for primary care physicians across the spectrum of women's health is so important. Can you tell us more about this work, what motivated it, and how it's being used?
Yeah, so I'm very lucky to be a part of a national organization called Society of General Internal Medicine, where there is a very large cadre of women's health educators. And I have to give thanks to one of my mentors, Dr. Melissa McNeil, who has trained a lot of these women's health educators. And we have sat around for years trying to figure out how to train internal medicine residents, family practice residents, nurse practitioners better in just primary care women's health. And there wasn't really a resource. And so I did a workshop at a national meeting. I was approached by an editor at Springer saying, can you guys come up with a product of your choosing to kind of showcase primary care women's health? And so I contacted a few of my friends, essentially, in women's health nationally, and we decided to come up with a 39-chapter book with 77 authors from across the nation. And we picked chapters that were based on what we see all the time in primary care, written by primary care doctors, of things that primary care people need to know. And so we're actually really excited about it. It's been downloaded about 17,000 times by Springer. We use it all the time to teach our residents, and it's been great.
It sounds like it's really filled a void that in the educational space that is really important. It's been helpful to hear about some of the conditions that were highlighted in your book that really focus on important considerations for women's health and the importance of having good education and training about women's health and primary care, but I'd also like to talk about gender and sexual diversity. So can you talk about health and healthcare for sexual and gender minorities, which may include individuals who identify as women, but may also include individuals who identify as non-binary?
Yeah, so I've trained in Pittsburgh my entire medical career, and my reference is training in Pittsburgh and the care that we provide in this community. And so I'll talk about training in our clinic and what we provide for our patients. So about 5 or 6 years ago, my partner, Dr. Ufamara, and I realized that a lot of LGBT patients were coming to our clinic, and we weren't doing a very good job of taking care of them. And so over time, we organized many providers in the area, from surgical subspecialties, OB-GYN, Uro-GYN, endocrine, OB, to really come together to provide better care for this community of patients, because it really takes an entire network of providers to care for the LGBT community, especially the transgender community. And so in the last several years, we've seen about 250 new patients in our clinic. We have a lot of friends that provide great care for these patients, and we're working on getting better services for them through the health plan.
That's wonderful and so important to know that there's a commitment to ensuring that safe and trusting relationship that you talked about being so important for women, but being so important for everyone in the context of health. Dr. Chilstra, I'd also like to ask about what you're feeling most excited about or most hopeful about when it comes to sex and gender and women's health.
So I think there's a few things that I'm hopeful about. One is that there's many, many people interested about being better trained in taking care of the LGBTQI community, both in the medical school and residency programs. There's new fellowships, as well as other providers in the area kind of joining our team to come together to really care for this population. And so that's exciting to see, as well as just locally as a and at the national level. So that's number one. And then number two, I think that over time, women are going to become better advocates for themselves and also for each other. And we're starting to see that both in healthcare and in other aspects, you know, the workforce, in childcare, in their partnerships. And so I think the community is growing up together.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Tilstra, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us on Good Health, Better World about sex and gender and the impact on health. It's been really wonderful to learn more about the work that you do, and I want to say thank you for the wonderful care that you provide.
Thank you so much for having me.
Everyone should have easy access to resources that help them navigate their healthcare journey. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Good Health, Better World, presented by UPMC Health Plan. This is your host, Dr. Ellen Beckjord. Be sure to tune in next time for more insight and visit postindustrial.com/goodhealth for resources and show notes. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes. It is not medical care or advice. Individuals in need of medical care should consult their personal care provider. Views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely their own and do not necessarily reflect those of UPMC Health Plan and its employees.